Hello, and welcome to the TV Movie Rewind Podcast with Matt and Todd.
Hi, everyone.
Today, we are doing something a little special in honor of our recently departed grandmother. We are dedicating this episode to the memory of Lillian Zakia, who passed away recently at the lovely old age of 96. She was a constant presence in our lives, and she was a huge fan of Agatha Christie and Sherlock Holmes and other mysteries. So we are dedicating this episode to her. And with us to celebrate the life of Lillian Zakia, as well as discuss this movie, is our sister, Kristen, returning.
Hello.
And for the first time, our mother, Cheryl.
Hello.
The movie we are doing today is the Agatha Christie Evil Under the Sun, directed by Guy Hamilton and starring Peter Ustinov as Hercule Poirot. It is from 1982. It is probably the first whodunit mystery movie that I ever remember seeing. And although Grammy's favorite Agatha Christie character was Miss Marple, unfortunately, I'm just more familiar, and I think everybody else is here, is more familiar with Hercule Poirot, and particularly the Peter Ustinov ones. This is one of six movies where Ustinov starred as Hercule Poirot. This is the second one after Death on the Nile. And then there was three TV movies, 13 at Dinner, Murder in Three Acts, Dead Man's Folly, and then a final theatrical movie, Appointment with Death. But this one is, again, it's a murder mystery, so I hate to say it, but it's the most fun. It's the one with the most kind of wacky characters. There's a bit of black comedy and a bit more tongue-in-cheek humor. And it has one of my favorite swimming sequences ever filmed in any movie.
Yes. Yes.
I think everybody at least here knows what I'm talking about.
The guy Speedo?
Well, no, it's when he when he wades like ankle deep in the water and starts just doing the swimming motion.
Like he's doing the crawl. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when someone asks him if he's been swimming,
did
you see me?
It's a lot of fun. So as I said, this movie was directed by Guy Hamilton, who had a history of directing some James Bond movies. He directed pretty much the last of what Sean Connery did, and the first of what, why can't I think of his name? He's my favorite. Roger Moore did. Goldfinger, one of the most popular and famous James Bond. Diamonds Are Forever, which is possibly one of the worst James Bond. Live and Let Die, the first for Roger Moore. And The Man with the Golden Gun, which is also just not very good. But Goldfinger and Live and Let Die are both decent movies.
Yeah, those are good movies.
So, unless anybody's got anything to say.
No, for me, I think the first one of these that I had seen, maybe the first murder mystery I had seen is, and I don't remember exactly which one, but it was probably one of the several iterations of Ten Little Indians. And
then there was one, like, I think it is.
What's that?
And then there was one, I think is what it's called.
And then there were none.
No, there were none.
Oh, then there were none.
Probably
there
that
was one.
Oh,
is
I thought
it was one
something?
Or none.
It's it, none. And then there were none.
You're right. Chris. I think it might be that one.
Yeah.
I think that still remains my favorite, but this is a good one. This is a really good one.
I think it was 10 Little Indians because, unfortunately, Agatha Christie was a bit of a racist, and I think originally that was what it was called, but then they changed it.
Well, originally
How
what
dare
it was
you?
Originally what it was called, we won't say.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
None of that seems to come across at all in this movie.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately,
it's over time, we'll say.
Yeah, you go back and you'll find that, unfortunately, most writers just were not as enlightened as we are today. And, it is what it is. But yeah, this movie basically begins, well, it begins with a body being discovered on the English moors, but you almost forget about that as soon as the movie begins proper, and is referred to again later. But it starts with a dead body of a woman being discovered on the English moors, and then it cuts to her who now people know when we're recording this. Only it's not AM, it's PM. So anyways, he enters a
Hercules parrot.
He goes, it's an insurance company that he had basically solved a case for, and they want him to solve another case that a rich man, Sir Horace Blatt, had brought in a jewel to be appraised and insured for, you know, a couple of million guinea at the time was the English.
Yeah, it was supposed to be like 50,000. Well, actually, I think they were using both money, but it was something like 50,000 pounds or something.
And it's, of course, an obvious fake. And one of the questions both Hercule Poirot and the insurance adjuster both have is, why would a wealthy man bring in a fake jewel for appraisal? So they hire him for the case, and he goes out to visit Sir Horace Blatt, and he gets the story from Blatt that he gave the jewel to a rather famous actress, Arlena Marshall, and she basically ran off with it and married another gentleman, and he was basically just trying to cover the loss of the jewel. And he employs Hercule to see if he can get the jewel back from Arlena, which really sets off our plot as he goes to an island, a fictional island in the Adriatic Sea, where he knows Arlena and her new husband will be vacationing. And this is where the bulk of the movie will take place. It's this little island at a resort run by a woman named Daphne Castle, played by Dame Maggie Smith, who also appeared in Death on the Nile and as a different character. And of course, everybody arriving at this island resort will be a suspect in the murder of what will be our most hated character in the movie, Arlena Marshall. She's just a terrible person, and we will find out everybody will have a reason to have murdered her.
Yeah, she's not cool.
What is pivotal to the plot as well is, as they are taking their little ship to the island, a cannon is fired off, and it's established that every day at noon, the island fires off this cannon, so you'll know when it's noon every single day.
I always wanted to know, who was firing the cannon? You never saw anybody but the people on that resort anywhere on the island. You never saw another person except for at the very beginning when the porters brought like their luggage up.
It must have been a town there.
Yeah, it's from somewhere else, because it's like they mentioned that it's in celebration or like commemoration of some battle that presumably happened at or around noon. But I don't know if it's near the resort. I don't know if it's at the resort so much as just nearby.
Yeah, I think they establish it's like an island across the bay is actually firing off the cannon.
Oh, okay.
But it's that's not important. What is important is that you will hear a cannon shot going off, and everybody knows it's noon. So as soon as we get to the island and we're introduced to our cast of characters, like I said, Dame Maggie Smith is playing Daphne Castle, who owns and runs the resort. And we will find she has a romantic history with Kenneth Marshall, who is now married to Arlena, played by Kenneth Marshall is played by Dennis Quigley. Arlena Marshall is played by Diana Riggs. And Linda Marshall, played by Emily Hone, is Kenneth Marshall's daughter and Arlena's stepdaughter. And Arlena Well, Elena treats her like the classical stepmother in most fairy tales. She is right. not very kind to poor Linda, who clearly doesn't want to be there. She's the only child amongst all these much older people on this island. And before I say there's nothing for a child to do there, it's the 1930s. I don't think there was anything for a child to do anywhere on the planet.
That's true, too. Nothing was catered right. to them at all.
Right.
Also on the island is Rex Brewster, played by Roddy McDowall. He has just written a salacious tell-all book about Arlena. Arlena is a famous actress. She's done Broadway shows. I don't think they established her as a film actress so much because, you know, it's the 30s. Film is a thing, but it's still, you know, it's the Broadway plays and all that that are still the high-end attractions. And they, you know, not only did Daphne Castle have a rivalry for the romance of Kenneth, but she also was an actress and performer herself. And there's a fantastic scene where they both perform the same song and dance routine for the gathered guests. So Rex Brewster has written the novel, and he wants, well, not a novel, but the tell-all book, and he wants Arlena to sign off on it so that she can't sue him when the book hits the stands, and she refuses to do it. Also in attendance are the married couple, the Gardners, played by James Mason and Sylvia Miles. They want to have, they've already established, or I should say, advertised that Arlena is going to be the star of their next big production. So they desperately want to hire her on. And she is, of course, refusing to do that as well. So that gives the Marshalls motive for murder. Then we have the Red Ferns, played by Nicholas Clay and Jane Birkin. And Jane Birkin was also in the previous movie, Death on the Nile, playing a different character. And Nicholas Clay, I think people like Todd and I will remember him as playing Sir Lancelot in Excalibur. So they have actually, at first you don't think they have anything to do with anybody, but then it becomes clear that Patrick Redfern is enamored with Arlena, and Arlena is just as enamored with Patrick. And they don't make any real effort to hide those feelings from anybody on the island. I mean, it's pretty obvious their flirtation. And, you know, Kenneth, who, you know, sees it, but, you know, he's the proper English gentleman. So what's he to do? So while all this is carrying on, we also see Jane Birkin playing, you know, the wife of Patrick, seeing her husband cheat on her. She's very demure. She's very
pale, very waifish kind of.
She dresses down compared to the other women.
Well, she can't expose her skin to sunlight.
Right.
She has
vertigo.
She has intense vertigo, and she's just very, very shy.
Very meek.
Meek.
There you go. Yeah.
Yes. And by the end of this movie, you'll find out why Jane Birkin is my Whit Bissell Award winner, because she is playing basically two characters. So at this point, I think I may have spoiled the movie. And, you know, as normal, we don't hold back on spoiling things. But if you really want to see this movie before we go any further, I suggest you pause the podcast now. Check out Evil Under the Sun and watch the movie and then come back and listen to the rest, because we will be spoiling who done it and how. And that's basically really what Agatha Christie, I think, is, well, most famous for writing the novels, is their whodunits. And if you pay extreme attention and can bridge gaps on your own, it is possible, probably not to come right down to the full conclusion, But if you're paying attention to this movie, you can definitely tell who's lying about where they were and when. Now, that may not be enough to say, yes, they're the murderer, but you could tell whose alibi doesn't add up. And again, that's kind of the twist to most Agatha Christie movies or stories, is the victim ends up dead, but everybody has an alibi to where they were and when they were when the murder happened. And it's up to, in this case, Hercule Poirot to figure out who and why. And again, where, as I said, Arlena, played by Diana Rigg, is our murder victim, there's plenty of who's and there's plenty of why's. So after a lot of setup and, you know, establishing the characters and the characters' relationship, Patrick decides he's going to go off on a little boat trip, knowing that Arlena is waiting for him in a little cove called Ladder Cove by herself, supposedly sunbathing on her own. But it's established that they're going to be a rendezvous. And just as he's getting on the boat, Mira Gardner decides she wants to go on the kind of a boat trip with him. And at first it seems like he's hesitant because he's going to meet up with a married woman while he's a married man. But as we will find out, this kind of falls into the plan. Because as they pull around to Ladder Cove, they see the body of a woman just lying under her sun hat. And at first there's, you know, oh, it's Arlena. He goes running up to her while Myrna is going to take the boat back. And he yells out, oh no, she's been murdered, strangled. And he says, Myrna, you wait here. I'll go back and get the authorities. To which, of course, Myrna's like, are you kidding me? I'll take the boat back and get the authorities. And he's like, oh yeah, that's a good idea, because the murderer may still be around. And as in fact we know, we will find out the murderer is still around. So what is now, we got to figure out who murdered her, as I said, and why, when, and how. Daphne wants to keep this under wraps because it's her own little private island and resort, and she doesn't want it, you know, a murderer to have known to been there. And she really kind of plays into Hercule Poirot's vanity by saying, well, what could be figured out that by the local authorities that you wouldn't be able to figure out and you wouldn't be able to determine? You know, do we really need to involve the authorities from the mainland? And of course, this, you know, gets Hercule Poirot to decide, yes, I will solve this case.
Well, plus she appeals to his legendary discretion, and he's a man of gallantry, and yes, will help a woman in need. Like, she
really, really, I
she
mean,
really just buries it.
She uses the entire stick of butter to him up.
It works.
So one of the first clues we get is there was a cave nearby where Hercule Poirot finds not only the fake jewel that he left in the custody of Horace Blatt, but he also smells the distinctive perfume that Arlena wore, meaning that she had must have been in the cave for at least a period of time to leave that scent behind. That's our first clue. When he interviews Horace Blatt, he finds out that, yes, he had just gotten to the island. He had seen that he had had a conversation with Arlena. He got the real jewel. He wanted to get the real jewel back from her, but she said she didn't have it. And when he saw the boat coming with Patrick and Myrna, he decided to leave. And he claims Arlena was still alive when he left her. And if Hercule Poirot doesn't believe him, he can ask Horace Blatt's boat crew, who were all on deck and watching, to confirm that Arlena was still alive when they left. When he interviews, of course, Patrick and Myrna both have the alibis. We were together when we pulled up into the cove and found her dead. She was dead before we got there. couldn't possibly be either of us. He's my alibi. She, you know, Myrna's Patrick's alibi, and Patrick is Myrna's alibi. The next likely suspect is, of course, Kenneth Marshall, the jilted husband. But Daphne comes to his defense. Unfortunately, at first, she lies to offer up the alibi, which, you know, exposes herself as a possible suspect and Kenneth. But their lies kind of confirm the truth, and it kind of eliminates them both as suspect, because Daphne can also tell they have the staff meeting every day at noon. We know they've established that she was murdered between 11:30 and noon, because, as we know, the sound of the cannon goes off at noon, and that's what everybody says. Well, I know I was here because the cannon went off, and I know I was here because I heard the cannon. And Daphne has her staff meeting every day around noon. James Mason says he doesn't have an alibi. You know, I was reading in the garden. There was nobody to see me. I went to go wash up, and the water pressure was low, so somebody was taking a bath somewhere on the resort, which was an odd time of day for me to think of somebody taking a bath. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, nobody saw me, so I don't have an alibi.
That scene in particular, his speech about how he's explaining to Poirot about how, well, I just can't tell you, but he's got the confidence of someone who knows he doesn't do it and knows Poirot can't link him anyway. So James Mason is one half of my witness.
Well,
his wife is the other half, because I love James Mason. He's just amazing. And I didn't get to choose him for Salem's Lot, so I'm doing it now. But I think Sylvia Miles as well, especially at the end during the denouncement or whatever scene. I'm giving it to them, because he's just he's got that like fantastic, almost sinister without being sinister sort of vibe. And then her playing against that as being just somewhat more blunt works really well. I like the two of them.
I loved her too. I loved her with her furs, and it's like a 1,000 degrees outside.
Yes.
Yeah, we noticed that. They complained about the heat and how hot it was, but they wore layers and layers of ball gums.
Suits and the whole bit.
Suits and furs and all kinds of
they were British ladies and gentlemen. They don't expose their skin to the sun.
Hercule was wearing spats.
Yes. Oh, he wore like a full suit to swim.
Yeah.
Which
with
didn't
a pocket
get wet.
Square. There was a pocket square in the bathing suit.
Yeah. That's right, because that's, you know.
But I mean, I just love James Mason's voice.
Yes.
I used to have an audio cassette where he read Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World, and it was just like perfect to fall asleep to, with his voice just reading, you know, dinosaurs crashing through the jungle after people, but it's still relaxing because it's Mason's voice.
And you can just imagine the dinosaurs with monocles and, you know, tuxedos. It's so classic.
So despite him saying he doesn't have an alibi, again, Daphne can say, oh yeah, me and my staff saw him sitting in the garden reading while we were having our, you know, chat. So that's how we know he isn't, you know, the murderer. Well, Hercule goes to young Linda, and the jilted wife, played by Jane Birkin, and their alibis are each other too, that they were out in a cove on the other side of the island while Linda was swimming. Christine, played by Jane, was sketching the cliffs.
Yeah.
Possibly not very well, because Hercule Poirot looks at the sketches later and like, yes, these are definitely
cliffs.
I thought it was pretty good.
I did too.
Well, Hercule Poirot is a bit of a critic, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they established that, you know, Linda can say, like, well, Christine asked me what time it was, and I looked at my watch, and it was 10 of noon, and she ran off in a panic because she had a tennis match with the others at noon. So she went running off. So I know where she was. And as she can tell you, she knew where I was. I was, you know, just had gone for a swim. And I remember because as I was going in for a swim, Christine called to tell me that I had forgotten to put on my bathing cap. And she puts on her bathing cap and goes swimming. Well, this story will kind of be contradicted by Rex Brewster, who is now our last suspect, because where was he? Who can say where he was? And he says, well, I was paddling over at that side of the island as well in one of these little paddle boats, and I was getting exhausted. And in fact, if you want to solve a mystery, why don't you try to solve who tried to murder me? And Poirot is like, somebody tried to murder you? Yes, just as I was paddling around the cove, that stupid cannon went off and somebody threw a bottle right at my head, missing me by inches. I mean, I guess 3 feet is still 36 inches.
I mean, Rex is a dramatic guy.
Yes.
We'll just say that. He's a dramatic
guy. I couldn't stand him. I thought he was so obnoxious.
I thought he was
my favorite. Roddy McDowall is my favorite because he's a character actor and he's been in so many movies back in the day especially, and I just like Roddy McDowall a lot. But he was a smarmy character. Very, slimy.
Yes.
He was fun to watch, yeah.
And I think you were supposed to hate him and suspect he was the one that had done it because he has no alibi. And when he claims young Linda was his alibi, he says, yeah, you can ask her because I went paddling into the cove where she was swimming. I kept calling out her name, but she obviously couldn't hear me. I almost ran her over. And finally, when she, you know, paid attention, I asked her if she would help me paddle back because I was exhausted. And of course, Linda didn't like him and didn't want to be alone with him.
Right.
So she said no. But when Linda is asked if this situation happened, she says no, she never saw him. Well, of course, Roddy McDowall is quite aghast because now he's facing the hangman's noose as the only one on the island without an alibi, and not the only one on the island with the motive to kill Arlena, but again, the only one without an alibi. And he runs up and confronts her, saying, why don't you tell, you need to tell the truth. And with her father and Hercule Poirot there, she does finally say, yes, I saw him there. What he's saying is true. You know, he was there. And, you know, she's like, her father's like, Linda, you need to tell the truth. You can get somebody in trouble with their lies. And Roddy McDowall very excellently says, in trouble? My God, you could get them hanged. Yeah. Well, Linda says, yes, it was just after Christine had ran off the beach. And a few minutes later, I saw her, and it had to have been at noon. She was up on the cliff above the cove. She waved at me just before, you know, he came around the bend. Now, if you've been paying attention, like I said, the odds of you figuring out the entire solution to this murder mystery are probably slim. It's hard for me to say because I've seen this movie since I was a kid and I was probably way too young and not paying enough attention to put the pieces together myself. So, you know, when it's announced at the end of the movie, you're just like, oh, okay, that's how it all would end. Watching the movie now, I can at least say, all right, this instance and this instance both point to this alibi being a complete lie. And therefore, by deduction, this is the only person who doesn't have an alibi and therefore must be the murderer. Hercule Poirot kind of goes through all the points that have been presented to him, putting the pieces together of what he knows. What's also great is every now and then, Daphne will come to him with something she read in a
yes.
crime magazine saying, this is how it happened and this is how they did it. I bet you she had her throat crushed with a nutcracker. I should see if there are any nutcrackers.
Two nutcrackers, yeah. I don't know how that was supposed to happen.
She does, though, like with one of her first theories, nails it. She does actually nail with one of her first theories almost exactly what ends up happening.
Which is probably what helped Hercule solve the mystery. But if you're paying attention, one of Christine's alibis is that she was seen at a specific time waving at Linda from atop the cliff. But Christine claimed to have severe vertigo, and in fact
was very vocal about it.
At one point she falls against Hercule Poirot when they're looking down at the beach at everybody sunbathing, and that wasn't even all that dramatic of a height for her to claim the vertigo got to her. Hercule mentions that when I went up on that cliff in order to see down into the cove where Christine claims that she waved at Linda, she would have to go to the very end of the cliff. And Hercule Poirot says, I got dizzy and I don't have vertigo. There's no way she could have done it. Also, Christine doesn't mention that Rex was down there at the same time, which means she lied about the time she was diving down at Linda. And since she had access to Linda's watch, she must have reset Linda's watch to an earlier time, giving her more time to get from the cove to the tennis match and take the bath that lowered the water pressure for James Mason's character.
And she asked Linda what time it was deliberately so she could establish her alibi.
You're starting to see that all of the stuff that seemed performative was performative.
Now, everybody, because this movie ends with the typical Agatha, the parlor room exposition, where everybody is gathered into the room, you know, all the suspects, and the detective goes one by one to how the crime was committed. And everybody is like, keeps objecting, like, look at Christine. She couldn't have fought, you know, Arlena, who was, you know, she was in good shape. And I wouldn't have mistaken this pasty white girl as lying on the beach, because here's what happened. Christina lied about the time and she ran across the island and confronted Arlena on the beach. Arlena tried to hide in the cave from Christina, but Christina knew she was there, and Christina knocks Arlena out.
Exactly as Daphne said.
And then she ran out into the beach dressed as Arlena in Arlena's swimsuit, wearing, you know, like a body lotion that made it look like she was tanned, and then lay on the beach with this giant hat covering her face, so that when Patrick and Myrna Gardner came around, they would assume, well, Myrna would assume that it was Arlena lying on the beach. And she only had Patrick's word for it when he went up and looked to say, oh, she's been murdered, strangled, go back and get help. And as soon as Myrna left, Christine ran from the beach, went back to the hotel, washed up, and made the tennis game. Then Patrick went into the cave where Arlena had been knocked unconscious and strangled her to death. Put her body back on the beach for whenever everybody else got there, and they could all say, yeah, look, she was murdered, and, you know, we have our alibi set in place. Now, of course, everybody's like, you know, you don't think I would have mistaken her for Arlena? And Hercule has an answer for everything they asked. And now everybody's like, all right, well, I guess it must have been them. But of course, very confident, Patrick Gardner says, and you can prove all of this how? To which point Hercule says, I cannot. I have no proof, but my story is the only one that fits all the facts that we know. Well, without any proof to offer the police, Patrick and Christina get up and say, well, I guess we're going to leave if that's what you all think of us. And they go up to pack to leave. And as they come back down, the reason Jane Birkin gets my Whip-Pistol Award is because her character has com- completely changed. Yep. Now that she no longer has to pretend to be the demure little Christina put upon wife, she is the supreme soap opera bitch.
Yeah. It's like a femme fatale now.
Oh, and it's an amazing transformation and really shows her acting range. It's incredible. So as they're getting ready to leave, you know, Daphne says, well, you haven't paid your hotel bill. And again, accidentally, Christina says, well, why should we pay them? They've accused us of murder. And of course, Patrick says, well, they can't accuse us of, walking out on a bill.
Implying that his check is going to bounce.
Yes.
But he's doing it because, you know.
Unfortunately for them, it was a trap. They needed his signature. And his signature matches the signature of a man wanted for the murder of the woman we probably forgot about at the beginning of the movie.
I know I did.
And it was all really a motive to steal the jewel that Sir Horace Blatt had given to Arlena. Because as Hercule Poirot goes to light Patrick's pipe, which he has never actually lit, Patrick pulls the pipe back and Poirot takes the pipe out of his mouth and taps it into his hand, and out comes the jewel. Case is solved. The proof is there. Hercule Poirot smiles and gets punched dead in the face by Patrick knocking him out. Kind of, you know, but he does not get the last laugh because Patrick and Christina are arrested. And as they are being taken back to the mainland in the boat, the island vacationers all kind of, you know, mock them with a mock toast from their own boat heading back to the islands. And thus the mystery of evil under the sun is solved. Todd is doing the same slow clap that Patrick did. Yes.
All the movies end with the suspected given the slow clap.
Kristen, did you have a favorite performance in the film?
I thought Mirna was great. I thought she was hysterical. Alone with her husband, she was very crass. But in public, she was all smiles she loved everybody and everything was just wonderful. But honestly, the biggest performance I thought was that island. I thought that island was horrid. It was a rock. It wasn't an island. I think of as an island. It was a rock.
It was a rock.
Not looked like a good time to me at all.
Oh, I might have enjoyed it.
People running up and down those millions of stairs.
Yeah.
Oh, that would have gotten
in
tired.
The heat. Yes. All like it painful. Was nothing.
And it's there's not in this beach. It's like there's like an inch of beach, and the rest is just rock.
Yeah. It was kind of cool.
It was great for swimming.
Yeah. Not really.
Hey, Hercule had a good swim.
Yeah. I would have been bored to tears after the first day.
Kristen did come up with a reason for why Alina called her stepdaughter a cough drop.
Oh, yes.
Think about what that was all about. But Kristen Googled cough drop. Tell us, Kristen.
Don't just stand there like a cough drop.
And that's basically what it means. It's like you stand there looking like you're going to do something or say something, but you do nothing.
Like a cough drop is known to do.
Right.
Must be a British thing.
And then the fictional, I tried to see if I could find that actual island. It was filmed in Mallorca, Spain, but I was trying to see if there's an island. And do you know how many islands there are in the Adriatic Sea?
Oh my God,
I didn't realize there was that many.
Oh, yeah, no. Greece alone is a bunch of them.
I looked it up. I forget the name of the island, but it is an uninhabited island that is...
Yeah, it's like Dragon something, Dragonera or something like that they use the aerial shots for.
And it's apparently a national park.
Yeah.
For whatever country it belongs to.
But the island itself, they filmed the stuff in Mallorca, so it wasn't really an island, a real island. In Tyrania is what they called it.
Yes.
Tyrania.
Did any of you read the book? Yeah. Anyone here read the book?
Yeah.
You did the book takes place in like a hotel in England somewhere, right? It's not on an island.
I don't remember. It's been so long ago that I've read it.
Well, again, I guess also in the novel, the character of Rex Bannister is a female.
Oh.
They rewrote it to a male for Roddy McDowell to play in the movie. But this is a movie full of great performances. I mean, everybody
they were all a character.
Especially, you know,
it's what makes these movies so much fun is the ensemble, and they each get to have their moment.
I mean, Emily Hone as Linda, the only young person on the island, is excellent. And, you know, you watch enough movies, you see why you see often the same child performers, because it's hard to be a good actor when you're that young. You don't have probably the life experience to do things, but she's excellent, and you really feel for her, and you understand her hatred of Marlena, and understand why she might have strangled the life out of the woman.
Called her Cinderella too. She was a wicked stepmother.
She's excellent, and she's acting with legends.
Yes,
she's acting with established legends throughout the film. So
she was like that moody teenager, and right. people yeah. were trying to like cheer her up, and she was like, "Screw you, this yeah. sucks." You know,
she was glad when Marlena got killed.
I think everybody was happy. A little bit, except for the Odells who wanted her to be in their show.
It's a role that had the movie been made, I would say 6 years later, Winona Ryder would have been playing her.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Right, yeah, yeah. So she's kind of, yeah. Yeah, kind of like a pre-Beetlejuice vibe, yeah.
Yep.
But it was also interesting to see Diana Rigg in, you know, like I said, the queen bitch soap opera role, yes. You know. Something.
Oh, yeah, she was fantastic. They were all great.
You would think of Suzanne Lucci playing the character, you know, not Emma Peel and Mrs. James Bond.
Her and Redfern were perfect for each other. Their two roles together. So
the handy. Women were all nasty and ugly spirited, and the men were all henpecked, except for the resident gigolo, yeah. Patrick.
Well, I don't think Daphne was all that bad.
No,
you know, she was still obviously in love with Kenneth, and you know, she was snarky when it came to Marlena, yeah, but right. she had reason to be.
Right.
Right.
She seemed to be understanding of that. Like, yeah, Daphne could have been a lot worse, especially to Marlena, but no, she was cool.
Well, she still had to run a resort. You
exactly.
Know? Yeah. Right. Of all people, she didn't want Marlena going back and bad mouthing her.
Well, you know how people get peculiar with a spot of murder.
And she did have just as many theories on the murder as Hercule Poirot did.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, the only mistake she made was lying about seeing Kenneth at the desk typing.
Right.
Which, you know, Hercule immediately debunks.
Right.
But, yeah, she was fun, too. She's probably the most fun character in the movie. And I would say...
Anyway,
well, yes, yeah. Yes, but even Poirot is, you know, so conceited and
Poirot is a killjoy too. Anytime somebody's having fun or talking fun, he has an angle to put with it. Well, yes, but also he's nosy. He listens to doors. This is before anybody gets killed,
right? But he is investigating the theft of the stone. Yeah.
He's technically there at a job,
but yeah, he. He can turn even the most ordinary conversation about, look at these people sunbathing, how they're all the same. But we must remember, there is evil under the sun.
Yeah.
That's the name of the movie. He said the thing. He said the thing. That's the movie. This is, it's fun if you've...
If you see the more recent ones, like the remakes.
Yeah, the Kenneth Branagh ones.
Yeah, and they fit well.
I'm sure he'll get to this one as well. But I bet it won't be as much fun. You know, because they're more darker, more dour murder mysteries. Where, like, even Death on the Nile has a much more serious tone.
Right.
Do it than right. this movie does.
Right.
This really is the most, at least as far as I remember.
The characters were laughable.
More comedic, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's something that you would almost remember, think of as, you know, it's just short of being a parody.
Right.
Right.
to the murder mysteries. And I'm basically looking to see if I can find, because I have Evil Under the Sun and I have Death on the Nile. I'd like to see if I can find Appointment with Death and watch that one as well. Just to at least see how that one goes.
Right.
You might have to make an appointment, though.
Yeah. I've read them all, but in my younger years. And my mother has a leather-bound collection of all of them that she's left to me. And my mom's was a Brit. And I intend to bring them and put them in my bookcase. Because she wanted to know that somebody would take them.
Yeah.
I remember seeing this movie with at least one time with Graham.
Yeah.
And I remember over the years, I would get her DVDs of the Miss Marple collections and some of the Hercule Poirot.
And Tuppence.
I don't remember Miss Marple movies.
There was a couple. I don't remember ever seeing them myself.
Yeah.
But I know Graham's favorite Christie character was Miss Marple. So whenever I could find one that I know I hadn't gotten her previously, I would get her one. One of those, as well as Sherlock Holmes, because, well, I like Agatha Christie. I only know from what I've seen in the movies, but I have read every single Sherlock Holmes story that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote, and that was because Grammy introduced us to Sherlock Holmes,
right.
And I've been a fan ever since. So, and we both really love the Jeremy Brett interpretation of Sherlock Holmes series. That was probably the closest to Sherlock Holmes in literature as they ever got.
Agatha Christie had an amazing mind. All of her books are so intricate, and most of them, you don't know who did it till the very end. You can guess, but you don't know. She had an amazing mind, especially to write as many books as she did.
She is
for so many different characters. She's got like several different characters she's written dozens of books for.
Well, and she's the world's best-selling novelist.
That stands to reason.
She's outsold Stephen King, and her books have sold more than...
James Patterson.
She's outsold James Patterson. The only book I think she hasn't outsold is the Bible,
right?
As you know, from what I know. But you know, even you know, Harry Potter. She's outsold Harry Potter She had a big lead on Sherlock
Holmes, but in just about every language as well, because she's internationally known.
And the murder of Roger Ackroyd,
English speaking world.
The murder of Roger Ackroyd, which is a Hercule Poirot mystery, is often assigned to high school students as part of their summer reading list.
Well, that's cool.
So that'll keep going too, because that is the first instance or the most famous instance of the unreliable narrator in literature.
Okay.
Did she do a movie called Cat Among the Pigeons? I always like the name of that one. Cat Among the Pigeons.
That I would have to look up, because I am just not that well versed. I know the Peter Ustinov Hercule Poirot movies and the four different films that I've seen made on And Then There Were None, also known as Ten Little Indians. That's my favorite Agatha Christie story, because it's kind of a proto slasher movie about a bunch of strangers coming together and getting bumped off
one by one.
One of my kids had to read that. I don't remember which one of them did, but one of them was assigned that they had to read it.
That's a good one. And as you know, I would later find out the novel ends with the plan succeeding.
Yeah.
It truly does end. And then there were none.
And they gave you at the very end the whole play-by-play of how it really worked out, because otherwise everybody was dead. You wouldn't know how it really worked out.
They added in the confession of the killer
was
placed in a bottle that they later find.
Exactly.
What happened to the couple at the end?
In the movie, it ends with her pretending to shoot him. In the novel, she does shoot him.
Okay.
And then she goes back to the house and realizes that just as the person tells her, you're the only one left alive in a house full of corpses. You can hang yourself or you can get hanged when the police come and arrest you. And
right.
True.
Hang themselves. But I guess, you know, at the time, they didn't think they could end a movie that way. So they rewrote the ending to have, you know, two survivors. Does anybody have anything else to say specifically about Evil Under the Sun?
No. I'm good.
No, I don't think so.
All right. Well, does anybody have any recommendations of other movies? They, you know, if you like this movie, you want to check out this movie, or if you like this movie, this is a reason to check out Evil Under the Sun.
Well, I think it reminds me of like the more recent movies, the modern movies of like Knives Out and The Glass Onion.
Yep.
It really reminds me of a lot of those with that.
Knives Out and The Glass Onion.
Yeah.
Those are definitely Agatha Christie inspired.
Yeah, definitely.
Character, I forget his name, Beauregard or something like that.
Yeah. Todd?
So I think if you like Clue, I think this is
Clue's
a good one.
An excellent one, yes.
Clue's is a great movie. It's a bit more comedic than this one, but it's got the same sort of like, you know, each character has their own thing going on. Each has a motive kind of vibe. We've talked about it a couple of times. The Last of Sheila is a lot of fun murder mystery. And
With James Mason.
Also with James Mason, right. I think if you're a fan of the more recent ones with Johnny Depp, is he in both of them? Is he in both the two new ones, The Death on the Nile and Orient Express? But I think those capture... a similar vibe to what you're going to get with this one. So, and they haven't done this one yet. So, yeah, check it out.
All right. I'm obviously going to recommend the previous movie starring Peter Ustinov, Death on the Nile. I'm going to second Todd's recommendation of Clue. And then go even more slapstick comedic with a movie we've discussed before. Private Eyes.
Oh, Private Eyes.
Because that's, you know, almost an outright parody of Agatha Christie movies as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Fitting especially within the time frame and all that. Yeah.
All right. So before we get into the final part of our podcasts, we also have the more where we try to come up with a more salacious,
an exploitive title.
But Evil Under the Sun is really hard to top.
Right? It really is. That was pretty good. And the fact that they got him to say it, they figured out a way for him to say it.
Yes.
I thought was unbelievable. The name dropped too. Yeah.
I mean, because even I was like starting to think like everybody wanted her dead.
Right.
You know, an island full of suspects. Nothing I could come up with is more salacious than Evil Under the Sun.
Right
from the beginning, the women were so nasty to each other, you kind of wish they'd all be victims.
Oh, I just came up with a great title. Bitches in Heat.
Bitches. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. Every one of them, when they open their mouth, you'd go, oh, I hope it's her. I hope it's her.
Well, they all had an axe to grind with each other. They either wanted something out of Arlena or just knew Arlena for who she was. You know?
I mean, imagine going on that vacation where you hate everybody around you and they hate you. That poor Linda. Not like a good time to me.
Yeah, poor Linda. Like, everybody's so hostile to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, with the exception of like Christine, but she's more or less forgotten because that was by design to just be in the corner. No one suspects. No one really thinks about. Everybody feels bad for her.
No. All right. So then, I guess before we do our Magnificent 7 Degrees, since we are dedicating this movie to the late this episode of the podcast to the late Lillian Zakia, I just wanted one of the memories I have hold special is she used to have this trivia game where every time you got a question right, you got a little piece of a puzzle. And at the, you know, the end, the goal was to be the first person to put your little puzzle together. And I remember playing this game with her several times. I remember this is where I learned that the theme song to MASH was called Suicide is Painless. It's my favorite memory of being with her.
I don't remember that game. I don't either.
I remember we would sit at her table, and I remember she would talk about taking us to Butterfields, which she never had the opportunity to do because they closed down. Right. But she had the opportunity to take us. But this would have been, I mean, I think I was about 10 or 12 at the time. So it's a long time ago.
It's like an earlier version of Trivial Pursuit, it sounds.
Yeah, but you know, it was like a little mini jigsaw puzzle. And when you got a trivia question right, you got to take a piece. And as soon as you had your, I don't even remember what the title of the game was.
I vaguely remember it now that you're saying it, I vaguely remember it.
Anybody else got a memory they'd like to share?
I remember going upstairs. I don't remember exactly why. I mean, I was young, I know that. So it was probably just a matter of she was minding me at the time. So I didn't get into whatever I was getting into. And no, I remember that she was a huge fan of these movies. Like invariably, she was always watching one of these or something like it. Or like, you know, Murder, She Wrote or something like that.
She had BritBox.
Yeah, she had BritBox later on. But yeah, this was always a constant, and I remember seeing the volumes of the Agatha Christie and the Sherlock Holmes.
With her being British, I think she just called it box.
Box, yeah.
Yeah.
Teddy, you know.
Kristen, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I just honestly, it's not movie related or Agatha Christie related, but honestly, I think about how. Well, I never would have gotten into Mahjong or liked Mahjong unless she hadn't said, hey, could you bring me back one when you go to China? And I was like, sure. And then I was like, oh, I'll get one for myself. And then we've got these big, huge, heavy things. And it's like, okay, how do we play? How do we do this? And we had to figure it out.
And we had it for years before we learned how to play it.
Yep. So I do remember that. I remember so we kind of all learned that together. Me, Mom, and Grammy.
I remember, and this is more a Matthew thing. We had a washing machine hose break downstairs, and it flooded the basement. And I was yelling to my mother upstairs, you know, the basement's flooded. And all of a sudden, Matthew disappears, and he's upstairs on the stairs on the second floor. And he's got all his belongings, his comic books and whatever. And I'm like, what are you doing? He said, well, the basement flooded and the house is flooded and we're going to float away. And my mother had to explain to him what a flooded basement was.
To be fair, I was only 21 at the time.
And they were very important comic books. There's a lot of key issues in that long run.
That's right.
He grabbed the most important things.
I had the first appearance of the Black Spider-Man.
Notice he left his siblings and parents downstairs. He just went up by himself.
He got the comics and toys safely upstairs before he let everyone know why.
That was his emergency kit.
It's going to be weird without having her around.
Yeah.
I remember her sometimes coming downstairs to join you to watch episodes of MASH.
And Friends.
Yeah.
We watched Friends together every episode. And she kept saying, how come I didn't know about this show? How come I didn't know about this show?
That's just how that goes.
Because she wouldn't listen to it. But then all of a sudden she got hooked.
Yeah.
It was just a bunch of crass young Americans having problems she couldn't relate to. All right, so I have a Magnificent Seven degree. Todd, do you?
I do.
All right.
Hopefully it's not the same as yours. But so James Mason was in the Toby Hooper Salem's Lot, one of my favorite movies of all time, with Jeffrey Lewis, who was in 10 to Midnight with Charles Bronson.
All right. Kristen, do you happen to have one?
I am horrible at that. No, I do.
Yeah, I don't even understand it.
All right. Well, I'm going to go with Diana Rigg, who played our murder victim.
There you go.
She was in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, where she her character gets married to James Bond and murdered immediately.
She's the one. Okay.
And she was Agent 99, wasn't she?
No, no. She was Emma Peel in Avengers. Kelly Savalas played Ernst Stavros Blofeld in, On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And Telly Savalas was in Violent City with Charles Bronson.
Not that violent of a city.
Back to Charles Bronson.
Yes. Well, you know, Charles Bronson had a very long career.
He had a long career and a lot of movies.
With a lot of people.
And a lot of dead bodies.
Oh, yeah. All right. So, well, that's going to wrap up this episode. Rest in peace, Lillian Zakia. You will be missed. We dedicate this episode in your memory. I want to remind everybody they can follow us on social media at X, Threads, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Movie Matt Sirois.
And Apple.
All one word, MovieMattSirois. We thank you for listening and hope to have you back next time.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Stay gold, people.